Good afternoon. Welcome to Line One, your health connection on KSKA Anchorage. I'm your host, Prentice Pemberton. In March of 2013, Dr. Matthew Dudley and his family received news that can only be described as a living nightmare. At only 37 years old and with two boys under the age of six, he was told that he had acute myeloid leukemia. Suddenly, Dr. Dudley and his wife, Brooke, were faced with the real possibility that she would have to raise their sons without their father. With a life turned upside down and all his dreams on hold, Dr. Dudley stepped back from being a doctor and began his battle as a leukemia patient. Over the ensuing 2 years, he and his family held tightly to the belief that he was an N of one and that survival was his only option. Joining me to discuss his ongoing struggle with this deadly disease is my guest, Dr. Matthew Dudley. Welcome to the show, Dr. Dudley. I appreciate you sharing your story with us today.
Thank you for having me on.
I want to take just a second to remind our listeners how we can be reached with your questions or comments. You can call us locally at 550-8433 or on our toll-free number at 1-888-353-5752. And the last way to reach us with your questions or comments is by email at line1@alaskapublic.org. You got to spell that out, L-I-N-E-O-N-E. All right. First question. In the intro, I mentioned something about being an N of one, and how can you talk a little bit about that and what that, how that applies to people who get a diagnosis of this magnitude?
Yeah. So, N of one comes from basically a statistical idea that in every study you have a number of people, and over time, people have come to the idea that an N of one is basically a study where the individual is the one sole object of that study, and you can look at them and see how things come out. And I think this day and age, when we look at a lot of statistics when we're dealing with medicine, you hear all about the power of a study, and you hear about the number of people in it and the number needed to treat, and over time, people feel like they become just a single number within this whole mathematical equation of medicine. And I basically kind of stepped back and said, look, sometimes we think about how an outcome is related to a single person, and that's what I'm going to do here. I am an N of one, and I encourage all patients now to think of themselves in that respect, because we are all individualistic. We're all our own being, and those strengths that we have unto ourselves can help us get through these situations.
And so often in these kind of situations where there's a serious diagnosis, people think, they look at the numbers, 25% survival rate or 10% survival rate, and thinking of yourself as an N of one for me kind of means, why not 100% survival rate?
Exactly. I think maybe later on we'll talk kind of about my prognosis and whatnot. And, you know, some of these diseases have horrible prognoses, and you don't really want to think about that. And if you think about that, you go down that pathway of negative thinking, and you can't do that. When you have a diagnosis such as this or many of the other terminal diseases that are out there, if you think that way, it almost comes to fruition. So you need to make sure that you try to keep a positive outlook. And if you step back and say, look, I might not be the number. I might, if the possibility is only 10% of the people survive and I'm one of those 10%, that's great. You know, if you think, oh God, I'm doomed because I'm one of the 90%, then by all the likelihood, that's where you're going to end up.
The power of positive thinking.
Oh, undoubtedly.
All right, let's give a little bit of background information on you, like where you're from, what you're doing these days, as far as professionally.
Sure. So, I grew up in Colorado. I was a big Nordic skier. And so in your promo, you mentioned me being at the peak of my ability. I'm not sure that that's true when I was 37, but grew up in Colorado, went to a small school called Western State College of Colorado, skied on the ski team, tried out for the U.S. Olympic team a couple times, ended up meeting my wife through skiing, and she brought me to Alaska, which I fell in love with. And then after college, I went to medical school down in the Bay Area and ended up coming up here to the Alaska Family Medicine Residency, which I thoroughly enjoyed, and really had planned on going back to a small town when I was done. However, I happened into a job as a hospitalist here in town, which I thoroughly enjoyed, and it gave me a lot of good time with my children, which I think I might have missed out otherwise on. And so since then, I've been sticking around town, working as a hospitalist, enjoying my children until March of 2013, when I found out I had AML.
Now, I've known you for a while through your work at the hospitalist. I didn't realize you were that significant, that much of I won't say that on the air, but that serious of a skier. Like, that's tried out for the Olympic team a couple times. Huh?
Yeah, it was that was my big thing growing up. And I think that in the long run, that probably helped me tremendously, because it's this individual sport where you really rely upon yourself to get through a lot of hard situations. And for anybody who read through some of my blogs as I went through this process, you could see that definitely played a role in where I am today and kind of who I am. And I think in this community in Anchorage, we're extremely lucky because we have such a strong Nordic ski community, and it's awesome.
For those who might not be familiar, a lot of people don't know what a hospitalist is. They might know what an oncologist is or a pediatrician, obviously, but what's a hospitalist? What's your job specifically?
So as I mentioned, I was trained in family practice, so general overall medicine, and I kind of planned to be in a small town. But hospitalists are something that have come around in the last probably 15 years, really in the last 10 years. We work just in the hospital doing essentially internal medicine for adults, and this has now spread out to there are pediatrician hospitalists and even OBGYN hospitalists. We are essentially there all the time. It improves outcomes by helping people get through what has become a fairly difficult system to navigate. And we're more available, and we have a lot of connection with primary care physicians in the community to try and help foster that transition back and forth. But it also opens up outside practitioners out of the hospital to have more time.
So when your doctor doesn't come into the hospital, you guys take over there and then coordinate care and then...
Yeah, and I think that there are definitely doctors who want to be in the hospital, and we gladly would have them come and see their patients as a social visit. That's fantastic. And, it continues to build that rapport that they have with them. But at the same time, it's difficult for those people that are in their clinic or those physicians in their clinic to be able to answer questions all the time and to really understand that system if they're not there on a routine basis.
All right, so let's start getting into the meat of this. You mentioned March 2013. What was your life like? I know your wife's from Halibut Cove, grew up in Halibut Cove, which is a pretty unique story in and of itself. But what was your life like before you got hammered with this diagnosis?
So as I mentioned, I at the time had a two-year-old and a five-year-old that I was thoroughly enjoying. As a hospitalist, we tend to work week on, week off, or 2 weeks on, 2 weeks off. And that's why I was afforded this time with my children. And I would spend a good portion of my time off hanging out in the kindergarten with my five-year-old at the time. And I just really enjoyed that. Some other volunteer activities along the side as well. But really just enjoying having two children of that age, which is always a fabulous act, really.
Yeah. So the illness disease, describe for our listeners what exactly it is. I don't even know if I pronounced it right. I think I came close, but
well, there are definitely some different terminology in that, but AML breaks down to acute myelogenous leukemia, which is essentially an overproliferation of your myeloid precursors, which are basically your immature blood cells, which then they're called pluripotent cells. They can change into other cells. They can go from being these what are called leukemic blasts, which is actually the malignant form of what they are, but they can become red blood cells or white blood cells, which have unto themselves different types. And what happens is those cells essentially, because of some either genetic mutation or previous chemo exposure, many different reasons, these cells basically get stuck in that blast form. And I apologize, I am not an oncologist, although right. I deal with it. And then those cells, because they are over-proliferating, essentially cause a number of different issues. Because you're not producing white blood cells, you're at high risk for infection. Because you're not producing platelets, because your bone marrow is so focused on producing these blast cells, you're at high risk for bleeding. And then because the cells are not progressing onto red blood cells, you become anemic. And so all of these things play into why AML can be so devastating. And it's not akin to some of the other cancers where you hear about stage one, stage two, because these cells are essentially everywhere in your body immediately.
What were the cues? What were the things that happened to you initially that made you concerned?
So, interestingly enough, as a physician, a lot of times you feel like you have this great immune system because you're exposed to little bits of illness and you kind of cope with them. And over time it doesn't seem like we get as sick as often. But that year I noticed I was getting sick all the time, and I somewhat chalked that up to hanging out with my 5-year-old in the kindergarten, which turns out wasn't necessarily the right thing. But we had actually been on a trip when I suddenly started feeling a little bit more tired than I normally would have. You know, there were some activities that I kind of skipped out on that I think I would have normally been doing. And then I got a tooth infection, which I'd never had, and came back to work. And, you know, part of the blessing and the curse of a physician, while I was on vacation, I got myself some medication, took that, and the tooth infection seemed to be under control. I got home and was managed to sneak away from work and get my dentist to take a look at it. And they, you know, opened it up and drained some pus. And they're like, oh, that's pretty normal. Don't worry. That's good. And your body's fighting it, which I always feel bad. I hope that he doesn't think back on that and be like, oh, man. But that. And then one night I continued to play a lot of soccer in adult leagues here in town. And I kind of got kicked, which I don't normally bruise or have problems with, but my wife noticed that essentially the whole back of my leg was bruised. And I went to work one day and my leg was going numb, so I had a little bit of what's called compression or compartment syndrome, and it was mild, but it was definitely different. And so I had somebody order me some labs, and I got those, and I found out that, sure enough, I was anemic, my white blood cell count was low, and my platelets were quite low. And I had talked to some of my friends about that at the hospital, and they said, oh, you know, check it again. It's potential that antibiotic causes it, because a number of antibiotics do cause some bone marrow suppression. So I was off of the antibiotic for about a week, and I went back and checked, and my platelet count, which is normally around 140, was now down to 40 and dropping fast. So my oncology friend said, hey, let's get a bone marrow biopsy and see what's going on.
Right. For those of you who might be tuning in late, my guest today is Anchorage physician and leukemia patient, Dr. Matthew Dudley. On today's show, Dr. Dudley is discussing his journey with acute myeloid leukemia. You can reach us with your questions or comments at our local phone number. That's 550-8433. You can call us toll-free at 1-888-353-5752 and email us at line1@alaskapublic.org. Please don't hesitate to call in or write an email if you have a question or a comment about your own struggle or a comment for Dr. Dudley. All right. So you get this, you're getting all these symptoms. You kind of know pretty quickly, since your friends and physicians are all looking at your stuff and going, oh,
yeah,
man.
I mean, I remember telling specifically one of my friends that I asked, she's an infectious disease doc, and I looked at her and I said, tell me that this is some crazy virus. Tell me that I have something at that point in time, I mean, I was grasping for straws. I've been with my wife for 20 years, but I said, is this HIV? I mean, I was just hoping that it wasn't a leukemia. I think that obviously at some point in time, I realized I wasn't going to escape that diagnosis.
Yeah, so you find out that it's leukemia, and what's the, I asked this question earlier offline, but what's the prognosis for, you said not a lot of folks your age get diagnosed with this, so what's the What's the outcome, or what was the hope for you going in?
So, the prognosis, when you look at diagnosis for AML, the overall prognosis is a little skewed, partly because the largest cohort of people that get this diagnosis are over the age of 60, which having multiple other medical factors when you're over the age of 60 kind of increases your risk for negative outcomes. And the overall prognosis is about 15% at 3 to 5 years, which when you hear that and you're 37, you're kind of like, oh, this is bad news, right? And it was definitely emotional. And I mentioned this before we talked as well, that being a physician, you're right, I had access to some other literature, and I started looking. And when I was looking this stuff up, I just said, I'm not doing this anymore. I'm not going to look, because it isn't pretty. And I had to step back and started kind of my transition into being a patient, that you have to have some faith in what the medical community is telling you, and that they're guiding you in the right direction.
So you step back and you think, I don't need to look at this stuff. I need to trust the doctors and the professionals to sort of tackle this thing on my behalf.
Yeah. I still vividly remember Dr. Steve Liu is my doctor. By chance, I think he was actually in the hospital that week for his group, and I just kind of corralled him and said, hey, what do you think is going on? And he said, oh, come in, let's do this biopsy. And I specifically remember him calling me the day after that, and he's just like, are you home? Yep. You sitting down? Yep. And I remember exactly where in my house I was sitting, and he just said, it looks like you got AML. And my blast count at that time, you know, it needs to be over 20 to kind of have that diagnosis. I was only about 24, but the concern was that this is so rapid that it was going to happen quick. And he said, look, we got to get you on a plane. We got to get you to Seattle, which kind of was a shock, right? Here I am, a physician in town. I think like, oh, we really do a lot of stuff here, but there are some things that we don't do. And that night I was on a plane to Seattle.
That quick? He said, you're out.
Oh, yeah. And I think that, you know, that's the thing is, had I waited even another 3 or 4 days, there's a good possibility I would have had either other untoward side effects, or I would have needed to be medevaced down there, because we just don't deal with that acute of an illness up here.
Now, you mentioned in one of your blogs, which I read quite a bit of, obviously, it's like a couple years worth of writing, and the link is on my website, or on our website, so that would, at alaskapublic.org, that would be a good resource for people to check out. But you mentioned jumping over a fence and going for a run on a nuclear base or something. Like, do they know what causes this? Or
That's a good question. I mean, I think that anytime you get a diagnosis like this, you try to think back in your life and say, right, what is it? What did I do that got me this, right? And, the World Health Organization kind of breaks this down into four possibilities of kind of the types of AML. 80% of those are AML with no other cause, right? Mm-hmm. Mine fit into one that actually, I had the short arm of my chromosome 7 disappeared somehow, which led to this. And they find that by doing the bone marrow biopsy and the genetic testing on that. And it fit into a category of having myelodysplastic type syndrome, which I never had any of that before, as far as I know, of course. That being said, I was always fairly healthy and never even got really routine labs. So I don't know. Maybe I had it for a while. Talking about jumping fences and running around a nuclear base, my medical school had actually acquired this Navy base called Mare Island, and we all lived out there, and they used to do nuclear submarines, and I don't know that that's anything. It's one of those things you muse about while you're stuck in a hospital bed trying to think, what in the world caused this?
It looked like you had a lot of time to think and write, and I want to get back to that first night you get the diagnosis. Your wife, you guys are a young couple with young kids, and how do you have that conversation? What is that first night, that first week like with Brooke?
So I'm going to apologize if I start sniffling and crying here. I mean, I think it was a powerful time. And I was extremely lucky to have not only my wife, but her family who lives near us up here, and my family who is extremely supportive. But yeah, you know, I got told, and my wife was actually at work. And so I called and I said, you know, you need to come home. Please come home. We really need to talk. And I had already started looking for flights to get out to Seattle that night. And she came home, and I mean, it's hard to tell your loved one that, look, I just got like a really bad diagnosis, something that is going to change our lives and potentially could be the end of my life, which, I don't even fathom how much that must have hurt her to hear that. And I remember even telling my parents, because at that time I didn't tell them. I just remember telling them the night before that I was going in for this bone marrow biopsy, and we did it on Skype because they were watching my kids play. And I said, so yeah, there's some other news, and telling them that, and it's very, very difficult. And there isn't really an easy way to do that.
And when part of my research and reading your blog, I wanted to read just a small quote, and I got your permission to do this ahead of time. But that was when you were writing about Brooke and your initial, I guess it was during your early time in Seattle, yeah. You wrote, death is nothing to me. I either go to a better place, I hope, or I don't exist. But she, Brooke, would be left without the travel partner, the co-parent, the shoulder, the other half of her life, a raw nightmare. So I must fight this. There is no other answer. Can you talk a little about Brooke and what she meant during this whole process?
I think one is I'm extremely lucky to have her. She's an amazing person and clearly my best friend. It was interesting because this came early on when I was thinking about, geez, you know, what is she going to do? And I realized that sometimes, and I even tell patients this sometimes now, like, you have to draw strength from the fact that, like, you may have actually got the easy end of the bargain. Because if I would have died, at some point I will, who knows, but, you know, she's left to deal with being here, to tell my children, to tell my family, to hold everything together. And and to me, that was more scary than no longer existing, right? And I think, it's just amazing how strong she was through it. She obviously went with me down to Seattle, and we were lucky enough that her parents lived around the corner and they took our kids, and our kids were extremely lucky in the fact that they almost didn't even realize what was happening. And there were some funny parts, despite us being in this horrible situation. That was the first time that her and I had been alone on any kind of vacation in about 5 years. So
I feel like it took this.
Yeah, it was like, wow, we should have done this before when we're not sitting in a hospital, because I went here right into the hospital at UW. And but I remember laying there that first night and I just remember her trying to sleep on this little pull-out couch and futzing around. And I remember she did eventually get to sleep. And it's amazing how powerful your wife's breath is at night when you're not sure if you're going to hear it for a long time.
All right, your parents. Yeah. What's that conversation like?
So as I mentioned, when I first told them, it's interesting because my father's a physician that people in town may know here, because he came and did a sabbatical for me, took over my job when I needed help. But they also are a amazing couple. I remember telling my dad that, look, I'm going in for a bone marrow biopsy, which as a physician, he knew that that's, you know, that is not something you take lightly. That is not something you do. And I could see in his face kind of that worry again as we were doing this over Skype. And I could see that my mom was clearly very worried too. And but she didn't know kind of the ramifications of what that was. And I always still think and I wonder about what it was when they hung up with me. Like, what did she ask him? I've never really talked about that because we always have other stuff to talk about. But I was amazingly lucky in that my dad had already been giving up his practice in Steamboat, where they're from, and my mom had just retired from being a high school counselor. And they basically dropped everything, and they came to Seattle, and they were there within about 4 days, and they helped us throughout the whole thing because obviously my wife really needed to be with our children, and so she would go back and forth to Seattle. And we were extremely lucky in that this huge population up here who uses Alaska Airlines could donate us some miles so that she could get back and forth. But my parents were able to stay there with me the whole time, because throughout this, you need to have somebody with you, because when you're not in the hospital, you're still at extremely high risk of getting infection, and something can happen right away. I mean, you're walking around with platelet counts that are 20 sometimes, and you cut yourself accidentally or bleed, you're in a lot of trouble. And so we were really lucky that they could come and do that for me. It's an interesting thing to think about taking care of your adult, independent child all of a sudden. And there was definitely some times I wrote about walking with my dad who, yeah. You know, he's a pretty decent athlete, would go running with me. And here we were like strolling along. I was taking breaks every, 400 feet because I needed to catch my breath because I was so anemic. So. Yeah, pretty amazing that they could be there.
Yeah, you talked about rolling the IV pole around the corner and running a 20-minute lap around the...
Yeah, that's one of those things, like, when you rely so much on athletic interfaces throughout your life, when you're in that situation, the only thing I knew to do is, like, keep moving. And during my first round of chemo, you do this what's called the 7-3 regimen of ARC or cytarabine and another drug called doxorubicin. And so you're hooked up to this IV pole 24 hours a day. And I would just walk laps. That's all I could do. And in my mind, I envisioned like coming around these corners. At that time, I still was feeling pretty good. I hadn't lost a lot of weight or strength. And I just was sure, here I was walking around the corner, I was going to take some nurse out and dump this toxic stuff all over her. And never happened. But it's one of those things, you think of all these things when you're just sitting there with nothing else to do.
Yeah, being an athlete and going from that level of physicality to just barely being able to get around the unit, it's got to be pretty humbling.
Yeah, definitely hard to take. I think at point, thinking about that though too, as I think back to the nurses, it's like something else, how important the nurses are in this whole situation. And I was extremely lucky to have them. And I think that they encouraged me to keep that activity up. They were like, just got to keep going, just got to keep moving. And that's what you need to do. And so having that support was immense as well.
All right, I think we're just about at the halfway point of our show, so we're gonna take a quick break. Remind folks that you're listening to Line One, Your Health Connection on KSK Anchorage. Today, Dr. Matthew Dudley is joining us to discuss his ongoing battle with acute myeloid leukemia. If you have a question or a comment for Dr. Dudley, please you call in. You can reach us at 550-8433. Or you can call toll-free at 1-888-353-5752, and you can email us your questions to line1@alaskapublic.org. After this short break, we'll continue our conversation with Dr. Matthew Dudley. I'm Prentice Pemberton.
You're listening to Line One from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 8 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Line One on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back to Line One, your health connection on KSK Anchorage. I'm your host, Prentice Pemberton. If you're just joining us, my guest today is Anchorage physician Dr. Matthew Dudley. Today we're talking with Dr. Dudley about his ongoing battle with acute myeloid leukemia. As always, you can email questions or comments about today's show to line1@alaskapublic.org. You can call us locally at 550-8433. Or reach us outside of Anchorage on our toll-free number at 1-888-353-5752. Please remember that the show repeats tonight at 8 p.m., so if you're listening to this on Monday evening, you'll be hearing a tape recording, and we will not be accepting phone calls. So before we broke away, we were talking about Brooke and the kids, and so I kind of wanted, or Brooke and your parents, and now I want to get back to, like, you got two little boys, and there was a real possibility that you might not be around for them to grow up and grow old. I know in your blog you'd mentioned something about your earliest memories. Can you talk about a little bit about what it was like for you and the boys and what you shared with them and what you didn't?
Yeah, I think that's one of those things, because I was kind of ripped away from them, I didn't really have a whole lot of time to tell them what was going on. And at the time, we didn't even really know what to tell them. And the big thing is there are definitely a lot of resources to help families deal with that. But Brooke and I were lucky that we had her parents, and we just said, okay, you're going to go to grandma and grandpa's and hang out there for a while, and we're going to disappear. We're going on a trip. And we didn't really know what to tell them. And as we got into the first week, we found out, you know, that University of Washington has a very good program because they have a large children's hospital there also, and they're a referral center that they had some counselors for us to talk to about what to tell the boys. But I think the first thing that really entered my mind was, holy smoke, so my two-year-old and my five-year-old, like, when I think back to my first memories, this is maybe when I was four, I can remember something. Mm. But here I was thinking, oh, man, my little Finn, two-year-old, he is never going to know me if I don't make it out of this. And I didn't even know if my older son would really know me.
Right.
When we think back, I mean, how many people remember a lot about kindergarten? I mean, sometimes you remember some points of it, but you don't remember a lot of it. So that was pretty freaky. And so that was part of the reason I started writing, is because I remember sitting there on the first night when I wasn't sure at all what was going to happen. I knew that stuff was going downhill quick. I wrote them each a letter that hopefully someday they'll open and read. But that kind of got my kind of juices flowing for, like, what should I write about? And so then I started thinking, well, you know what? I could probably start telling more stories about when I was a kid, and maybe someday they'll read those. And so I started this Caring Bridge site, which I think you have on here a link to.
I do.
And yeah, people are free to go look at that if they want to. It kind of became this way for me to help get through each day. I would write something, and I would oftentimes think of some story that I had in my past and my history, and kind of relate it to what was going on that day, and in hopes that, yeah, someday my kids will be able to read this long string of jargon, probably, and be able to be like, oh, we kind of have an idea of what our dad was like. And hopefully now someday I'll get to sit down and actually read it with them still. That's my ultimate hope. But there was definitely some times that were hard in talking with the boys. Specifically, after my first two rounds of chemo, we came back up to Anchorage because I really wanted to come home and see them. And we had planned to do a bunch of bone marrow drives to leading up to trying to recruit people. I found out that my brothers would not be a match for my stem cell transplant. And so we were looking for other people and using that as kind of a way to do something good out of this situation. And one of the TV stations, I believe it was Channel 2, came and did something while I was in the hospital and filmed me and talked to Dr. Liu. And we didn't pay attention. We were just kind of like, ah, this is pretty neat. And we showed it to our five-year-old. And they talked about, you know, this is the prognosis, 15%. And Dr. Liu was like pretty dire about it. And our so by then Liam was six, and he's a pretty sharp kid. And he just looked at me and he just said, "Dad," and he started crying. He said, "I don't want you to die." And I think that was the first time it really set into him how significant this was. And I mean, man, that was hard. That was a hard moment. And I still think back on it and be like, "God, that was really ruthless of me." To think like, oh, hey, look, here, we're on TV. Like, you see, your dad's doing okay. Oh, whoa, that's not good. So I would encourage, you know, if people find themselves in this situation and they have children, to really try to use those avenues that have been figured out that are beneficial and that are comforting to tell children. And there are so many resources like that. I mean, up here, for instance, like... The Butcher Family Center, they do a really good job of that, and I've definitely referred people with kids to them.
That's the Susan Butcher Family Center at Providence, right?
Yeah. So they have a lot of resources, and I think a lot of the psychologists in town, too, have this ability to talk, because I think as adults, sometimes this is not something that we're programmed or we learn anywhere in any parenting class of how to tell your children that the badness has rolled into their life. And that's probably one of my biggest regrets of the whole thing, is just that moment. But amazingly, they've done well. I still sometimes wonder if my youngest Finn has any idea of what happened. You know, he was more excited that he got to go to Seattle for that next summer and hang out in all the water that was warmer, and he didn't have to wear his wetsuit or a life jacket. He sometimes asks if we can go back and live there, but I tell him that's okay. I think I've been there enough. So, yeah, it's... I think that the other thing that they added was it was just this... When they came to see me, it was something that just gave me even more strength to keep going through no matter what, because I just wanted them to someday be able to say, oh, we do know our dad. And I think that, man, sometimes I think back and I step into other people's shoes who don't have that luxury, and realize like, oh man, life can be really difficult if you don't have that support from your parents. So
I remember, my wife, who Jocelyn, who's works with you, would come in like with tears in her eyes, and she'd be saying, oh, I just read Matt's like his last post about his kids showed up, and she was heartbroken but touched. And it really is a gift that you give your kids to have that sort of I don't know, that script or that story there for them. There was times I saw some pictures of you that, you know, when you were undergoing treatment, that were looking pretty rough. How'd the kids deal with that?
Again, it's one of those things. I think that because they got to see me and we spent a lot of time, and in this day and age, we're extremely lucky, even though the fact that I got shipped away to Seattle, you know, almost 2,000 miles away, we still were able to talk, and they were able to see me on Skype and see that, you know, I was still there and I was doing okay. And that transition was fairly gradual. The time that I got really sick and actually lost a lot of weight and did not do very well, I was up here. Right. I'd come back and ended up in the hospital for 2 weeks with basically liver failure. And so they were able to come in and see me still. And I think that seeing me every day, that transition was not as drastic. And so for them, I think that it wasn't that obvious. And I kept coming out of the hospital and I kept trying to do stuff with them. I mean, even when I was in the hospital that time for 2 weeks, I came out and, you know, I was profoundly weak, but all I wanted to do is like, I'm going to walk across the street to the park with you guys and I'm just going to sit there. And that's what I'm going to do. And, me being there just gave them that feeling of like, hey, he's still here. And I think that that helped them a lot. And I didn't have to do anything special for them. It was just being around them. And I think that that's a big part of if you're going through something like this, make that time to be with your children.
Yeah, just showing up.
Yeah.
Being there. And yeah. A sense of normalcy, I guess. Dad's able to take us to the park.
And I mean, they can tell it's not normal, but right. At the same time, it's like, hey, he's still here, and we know, yeah, he's not gonna let us jump off the top of the playground. He's gonna yell at us. He can still yell. So,
all right. If you're just tuning in, I am discussing determination, hope, and healing with physician and leukemia patient Dr. Matthew Dudley. You can call us with your questions or comments for Dr. Dudley at 550-8433 or on our toll-free line at 1-888-353-5752. And the last way to participate is by emailing your questions to line1@alaskapublic.org. I do have an email here I'd just like to read. It's from Margaret, and it says, Dr. Dudley, I'd like to thank you for talking about how you are dealing with uncertainty, quote-unquote, in your life with cancer. I live with colon cancer and its presence in my life. I love your attitude. And it's great to be reminded that it's all in one's perspective. As an individual, there is always a chance of being a quote-unquote good statistic. Thanks again.
Yeah, I mean, I encourage her to keep up that belief. I think that, I think that's one of those things as a physician, I oftentimes find myself in the situation where I'm telling people like, wow, this is not a good prognosis, right? And we need to be realistic. And as a physician, I have always been somewhat of a realist in what I tell people. And I think that people deserve to hear that. But at the same time, yes, keeping that frame of mind that, aha, there is some light. It's kind of akin to the Dumb and Dumber quote of, so there's one in a million. I'm a one in a million, right?
Yeah.
And,
you're telling me there's a chance.
There's a chance. And so you have to kind of keep that in the back of your mind. At the same time, I'll step back into my doctor role and say that there are times when we as a healthcare profession do a lot of extremely invasive and not nice things to people. And you asked a while ago about the first couple days, and that was a conversation that I had with my parents and with my wife that, look, this could realistically go bad, and we need to have a plan, and we need to be able to say, I don't want this, and I don't want that. And I made it very clear to them that, you know, I don't want to end up on a ventilator. I don't want to end up on life support. That is not how I want my kids to see me.
Right.
If I go out, please let me go out. Do not drag that out. And so that's something important to remember, even when we are thinking about, yeah, you still have a chance. What does your life look like down the road? Which led to a lot of the decisions that I made throughout this situation. I mean, I had chances to go through different kinds of chemo or to go through less invasive transplant protocols. And I was like, I want this gone. And I'm willing to suffer with what I have to do now as long as I can potentially have that chance on the other side of not having this come back.
So the goal obviously is to make it through, but you're talking about advanced directives, which are sort of letting the doctors and your family know what your wishes are in the case that you should become incapacitated, correct? And unable to speak on your own behalf.
Yeah, I think that, communication is such an important thing between you and your physician, between you and your family. And as we are we're the most advanced creature on this earth, but sometimes we don't talk about what is obvious. We are all going to die. And having that discussion, and so that people understand around you who may end up having to make that decision, you don't want them to have to make that decision. You Right. want them to be able to, you know, rejoice in your life if that's what it comes to. And you want to be able to make that decision. And it's a hard thing for people to step back and say, geez, you know, I may not live. But the question is, yeah, what it, you know, if you're on a ventilator or you're unable to communicate with your family, like, is that living? And only you can answer that. And you don't want to get to the point where you don't have the ability to answer that. So I encourage everybody over the age of 30 to have that discussion with people that you care about or that you love or that may end up making that decision for you, so that when that time comes that you don't have to struggle with it. So
they're not making it for you.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, I want to go real quickly. We got our first phone call. So, Bob, you're on the air with Dr. Dudley.
Hi.
Hi, Bob.
Hi. Yeah, what I'd like to do, I'd like to stress the importance of getting periodic physicals. In my adult life, mainly due to financial constraints, had only gotten two physicals. The second one I got was 5 years ago. The doctor had me come back again because he said there were some anomalies with my blood work. I went back in. He took blood again. He called me back in the next day. My white blood cell count was 130,000. And he told me that I had chronic hemorrhagic leukemia.
Yeah.
And I would have never known had I not gone and gotten that physical because I had no symptoms.
Yeah, and you were, definitely lucky. And you are extremely correct that, you know, there's a blessing and a curse that I had being a physician. Like, obviously, some of the curse was knowing the ramifications, but part of the blessing was knowing, like, I knew something was wrong. And I had the resources to go and get that looked into relatively quickly. And we don't have those if you're not necessarily in the healthcare profession. Going and just getting your labs drawn one day after work is not always possible. You need to set yourself up to see a physician and whatnot. And that is, in my opinion, kind of a travesty of this country's healthcare system. But it can be prevented if you go on a routine basis, like you did, or like you said, you can find things that can be tracked that can help you prevent diseases. And we know for a fact that prevention of stuff is far better than the reactionary medicine that we oftentimes practice.
Yeah, right. Yeah, it's good. I kind of wish I had gone in sooner, although I'm in remission right now. But it, on a $1,500 a month pay, it's kind of hard, even paying the co-payments and the deductibles, to go in and see a doctor once a year.
Yeah, no, you're right. And obviously, I'll step into a little bit of a political realm there and say that I think that we are finally, as a country, making a step towards everybody having that chance by providing at least access to healthcare and to and to insurance. I mean, I think as a physician, there are times I curse insurance because of all the paperwork and the hoops that I jump through for them. But yeah, you go through something like this and you realize that, wow, without that, I wouldn't have got what I got as far as treatment, and I wouldn't have, insurance ends up being a very good thing when you're sick. And it's even better if you can prevent it.
Yeah, absolutely. Because I know the treatment I'm on, I'm taking a $400 pill once a day. If I took all of the money I made for an entire year, I'd be able to afford 45 of those pills.
Yeah.
All right, Bob, I really appreciate the phone call. That's a great point.
Thanks, Bob. Good luck.
Thank you.
All right, so I hear that doctors make the worst patients, right? Like counselors make the worst clients for therapists. So how was this for you as a doctor going in? You talked a little bit about the nurses. What did you learn from that perspective?
Well, like I said, I think that physicians, we tend to be type A personalities. We tend to be very controlling. And we like to think of ourselves as kind of the, you know, the big wig in this team taking care of people. But I realized really quickly that, wow, no way, man. Nurses are far more important even than us as physicians. I mean, truly the physicians, we sit around and we make decisions and we try to interact, but we don't have that personal relationship so frequently the nurses do. And I would love to thank every one of my nurses that I could. As far as being a physician patient, I think obviously it was a tough role to step into just because, like I said, I knew a lot of stuff that could go wrong. I think at the same time, I've had a few difficult patients of my own, and
right.
I was like, you know, I don't want to be that person. There are times when I oftentimes tell people, like, look, you know, if you're a really nice person in the hospital, you're in trouble because those are the people that have bad outcomes, right? So just be a jerk. But I couldn't bring myself to do that. I'm sure there was times that I was more outspoken than I should have been. But in general, I think I was okay. I think I ended up arguing more with my physicians when I did it. And usually it was around stuff that I wish that patients in general would stick up for. I mean, I remember one time when I was in Seattle, like, went in for a fever, and for 4 days straight, they kept drawing 2 blood cultures a day. And then every third day, they just had to pump me with more blood. And I was like, God, every one of these units of blood you're putting into me is a risk. So quit taking it out. We're not finding anything. And I finally just had to tell the resident, like, nope, I'm not doing it. And I got into an argument with him, but they gave it up and stepped away from their protocol, and yeah, probably saved myself a couple units of blood. And I think that patients should do that. I don't think that should be a physician who steps up and says that. So,
got to advocate for yourself.
Yeah, definitely got to advocate.
So Viktor Frankl, a great writer and concentration camp survivor, said, the last human freedom that can be taken from us is the freedom to choose our attitude of mind in any given situation. How was your attitude of mind? How did you, sort of a two-part question, how did you keep at bay the thoughts of, why me, this doesn't seem fair?
Well, I think you're never going to keep at bay the feeling of why me, but at the same time, I knew it was fair. It happens. I mean, and I don't know where that came from, but I definitely just was like, this happens, and so I got a deal. Again, the writing became such a huge part of my day. It was like I would go for a walk, I would get labs drawn, I'd get infusions if I needed them, and then I would sit down and I would write. And I would think about some good moment in my history, or occasionally trying to find funny moments if I could, so that those people that were reading my stuff weren't always dragged down by the way I felt. And every day I tried to turn that into why today was positive, why today was one step closer towards maybe my new normal. And I say new normal because life is not the same after you get this diagnosis, or really any cancer diagnosis. But that really helped me through. And I think that I would love to say that I was positive all the time, but I wasn't. Most of the pictures I was pretty happy in.
Yeah,
you learn, like, the
stage. You smile for the camera.
That's right. You smile for the camera. And you learn, then when people say, how you doing? You just say, yeah, you know, it's not the just routine, I'm okay. You have to think about it.
Right.
And it's hard. But I think that I was able to keep that frame of mind mainly because of that writing, and mainly because of all the support that I had from people. And I think that that's one other thing I would encourage anybody who's in these situations, either a life and death or a chronic disease, don't, even though you have to be somewhat self-centered about what's going on, don't always stay self-centered. Look for your community elsewhere. Talk to loved ones and family members if you can. If you can't, there is a huge resource that we have these days in the online communities.
Mm-hmm.
And there are people who go through things just like we do. And being able to make those connections can help you through so much. So,
all right. And some of those resources are available online if you want to go to Alaska Public. alaskapublicmedia.org and click on our link to our webpage. Those are listed at the bottom of the page show. What are the gifts? Do you have any gifts from this? I mean, as challenging as it is, what do you take from this experience that is positive?
Well, the first gift I take is that somebody who I don't know stepped up and gave me her stem cells. And the gift that I saw was that, man, humanity can be unbelievably caring. This person, I don't know, I actually found out her name just about a month ago, and trying to get in contact with her, for no reason, agreed to go through a short treatment, produce a bunch of stem cells, and give them to me. And so I walk away with that gift for sure. I walk away with the gift of every day seeing my kids and seeing my wife. It definitely means something. And I would still have that feeling if I hadn't gone through this, but man, it just makes it that much more vivid when you think about it. I think the other thing is that, yeah, I've learned to try and be a little bit more in my patient's shoes when I see them. And I hope that sometimes comes across to them that, yeah, you know, I have been where you're at and I want to try to help you get through this. And so,
Sharon, I got about 15 seconds for you to give us a comment. We're going to have to get off the air here. So can you give us your comment real quickly?
Real quickly, in life, you're a young person, Dr. Dudley, but I'm 73, but I had an experience where first I'd had breast cancer and I had had a childhood experience that had to do with assault, and suddenly I found myself at an airport. And my reaction to the TSA was one of the crisis and the trauma, and the cancer had created a situation where the examination the machinery said that because I was missing a breast, I was a danger, that I could be carrying something in that hole.
Sharon, I'm really sorry. I'm gonna have to stop you because we're out of time. I wish I could listen to your story, but thanks for the call.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.
All right. All right, Dr. Dudley, I think we're out of time. I would like to thank you very much for sharing your story. It was a real privilege. I appreciate you coming on.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
All right, please remember to check out the variety of links and information we have available on today's topic. Just go to alaskapublic.org and click on the link to today's show. If you'd like to continue the conversation, you can join us on Facebook. You can find that link on our website, alaskapublic.org. As always, please feel free to share your thoughts or comments about today's show with us at our email address. That's line1@alaskapublic.org. Diabetes Awareness Month each November is designed to focus attention on preventing and controlling diabetes. Since nearly 30 million children and adults in the United States have diabetes, this effort seems warranted. Dr. Woodard and Nellie Ayala discuss the state of Alaska diabetes prevention on the next Line 1, Your Health Connection. Pat Yak is the Chief Content Officer for Alaska Public Media. Evan Erickson is our web editor and audio engineer for today's show. Thanks for joining me today on Line 1. Till next time, I'm Prentice Pemberton. Have a great day.
Line 1 is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.